The views expressed on the Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, Friends of Community Radio, or any of the affiliate radio stations airing the show.
You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw. I'm William Goodenough.
And I'm Bursa Goodness.
The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWA LP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS LP in Columbus, Ohio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. If you care to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. This is the final of three segments of Burst's conversation on The Final Straw with post-left anarchist Paul Z. Simons about his recent trip to Rojava, the revolutionary region in northern Syria on the Turkish border. You'll hear Paul share his understandings and experiences of property and economics and ecology on the ground as they're developing through Tevdem and within the structures of democratic confederalism.
And then we talked about private property a little bit. I want to talk just – do we have time to talk about economics real quick?
We got total time. Yeah.
Okay. So just to begin with, PKK has always been anti-capitalist, always and always will be. It's and PYD has always been anti-capitalist and always will be. So starting with that as a framework, what are they currently doing in Rojava to be able to implement an anti-capitalist regimen in terms of the economy? And a lot of the stuff they are, you know, a lot of the stuff they're not going to be able to address right now, and they're not addressing because they're working more at the political level as opposed to the economic in Jazeera Canton. In Kobani Canton, completely different story. In Kobani Canton, the destruction of the city, as horrible as it was, freed them up to begin the process of messing with private property in a very real way. And Ocalan's ideas, as well as the ideas of PKK and PYD, don't destroy private property because they're not communists, they're not Marxist, but they conceptualize private property as something that is beyond what is purchasable. So in other words, they deny the ability of the individual to actually own private property in the way that you and I understand ownership. Like this land is mine. I have the receipt. I make the payments. It's mine. That's not their view of private property. Their view of private property is based on use. So in other words, say you and I go into a store and it's like, wow, this would be a great radio space. Let's take it. And so we move in, we put some radio stuff in there and we begin producing some radio programs and things like that. As long as we continue to use it, it's ours. When we're done with it and we abandon it, it can become somebody else's.
Is it, and in the use, it's considered like, but would there be the assumption or the presumption that like, okay, well, they're done programming for the day. Hey, I want to go over there and use their equipment respectfully or whatever.
I don't know. That I'm not sure. And I'm sure that those would work out. Yeah. And, you know, again, our backdrop here is most private property in Rojava is land. Right. And the land that is being used, some of these villages have been using it for centuries. Before I went, and I'm from Northern Colorado. My dad was a civil engineer at Colorado State University, so I have a vague understanding of irrigation and what that looks like. So when you look at Rojava from satellite, from space, you know, you see fields, agricultural fields that are, you know, one I saw was probably 4 or 5 miles wide and 20 to 30 miles long, which wow. Indicates some pretty intensive non-irrigation agriculture, as well as the fact that it's unlikely that just one individual owns this, right? So this private property of use expands out to the use by the commune of the property as well, because as strange as it sounds, that's fundamentally the way it has been working in Rojava for the past few centuries. And so in many ways, at least as regards land, this private property based on use has more to do with the way that the land is actually has been used in the past and is thought to be, you know, thought it will be used in the future, as opposed to, you know, the deeds and things like that. I mean, do individuals hold deeds to these lands? The answer is no. Most of them are held by a group of families within villages. So it kind of takes that system and, as opposed to formalizing it, kind of almost deformalizes it and says the deeds are interesting, but the use is key.
Yeah, and that ruins the idea of speculation.
Correct. Exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
Because there's no paper trail to trade off. Okay. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And it also, I mean, the next thing is, you know, now let's follow this for the sake of argument. Let's follow a crop from this field that's owned communally to, or that's used communally and hence owns communally to market. Now at market, the Rojava has as yet to figure out what to do about money, about, you know, the general equivalent. They're currently using the Syrian pound. And the Syrian pound, like all other money on earth, is basically a fiction. And it's a bad fiction because obviously it's been losing its value. And so that's been a real problem within Kurdistan. And the economic folks, I only spoke to one guy who was kind of clued into what was going on there economically. And he was thinking that with the democratic Syria, once democratic Syria, this kind of confederation of, you know, free the Free Syrian Army spaces, some of the other areas, Aleppo, that type of thing. Once Daesh is eliminated and Bashar Assad and his state is destroyed, that they would be coming up with some type of general equivalent, and that they would have to base it somewhere in some type of bank, which would be, I think that the Kurds would have a problem with basing it in like a Syrian National Bank, something like that. So that is something that they're going to have to figure out over time. I had a real interesting discussion with the guy who's there, who's responsible for the book Stateless Democracy. His name is Jan Steen, and he's a Dutch guy. He's been in Jazeera province for, I think, 3 or 4 years, sponsored like some world forums there, that type of thing. A libertarian socialist, not really an anarchist, but definitely he and I saw eye to eye on a lot of stuff. And, you know, we were kind of going back and forth, and it's like, you know, in a revolutionary situation, what can you possibly base currency on? So we kind of went through the different revolutions that we knew about, you know, and the French Revolution being the most interesting, where they threw out the monarchical livre, which is based in gold, and they came up with this is the convention did this, the assignat, which is based in property. It was based on, you know, its exchange value was for property that the aristocracy who had left the country had the revolution had taken over. And so, you know, if you brought in 1,000 assignats, you got 1,000 assignats worth of land in, say, you know, Provence or something like that, which is, of course, bullshit. But that's the way that they backed it up. And so we were sitting around thinking about it. And he's like, what do you think about oil? And I said, you know, oil would be a real interesting thing to base it on, you know, because admittedly it's a resource that's going to be going away, unlike land. But to be able to base a currency on, you know, at least something that backs it up initially, you know, oil is just as good as anything else you can pull out of the ground. So that's kind of the level of discussions that they're having right now. It's like, wow, what do we do about the general equivalent? You know, we obviously still need money. How can we avoid its speculation, and how can we tie it to something such that it's not going to float horribly against, you know, the euro or the dollar or the ruble or whatever. So those are things that they're going to have to work on. But the primary issue, I think, for me at least, the gut level issue was one of private property and how to deal with that. Because, of course, we've seen it dealt with horribly by the communists. And, you know, the idea of the communal property effectively owned by the state but worked by slave peasant communists does not and will never likely obtain in Rojava, which I found very reassuring. Very reassuring.
So if a person were to come to a community and you know, and not have the resources or the ties to a family or a community necessarily, and they had a medical issue or were hungry or needed shelter, who would they turn to? Would they just turn to the people who happen to live there and say, like, hey, this is my deal. I don't, you know, I don't have these resources. But is the what is distribution of services and goods look like? Like, because you've talked about property and you've talked about currency systems, but
right. It goes back to the system they're in the process of evolving, and this actually is some of Ogillon's work. You know, in a liberal democracy, the most basic political unit is the individual, right? And the individual expresses his or her will every 2 to 4 years by voting, paying taxes, you know, being arrested, whatever. The most basic political unit in Rojava, in their political system, is the commune. And the council that is responsible for the commune. So it's the block association. So you and I, let's say you and I decide to move to Kobani, which would be a rather interesting thing. So let's go to Kobani. We're going to occupy a space. We're going to open up a radio station. All of a sudden we find ourselves, we can't get US dollars in anymore for whatever reason. So we would go to our commune council and say, wow, you know, we don't really have anything, any food or anything, and we were wondering if you guys could help us out with that. And the commune council then would be responsible for going to Tevdem or the responsible food authorities and then getting food for us. In other words, we wouldn't be sent. It becomes their responsibility as the commune council because they're the ones who would be speaking for us. So, the system was utilized during the siege really effectively and was incredibly successful. So not only were they providing food, clothing, and shelter in the midst of, you know, the siege, basically, they were also taking responsibility for intelligence gathering. They were taking responsibility in some extreme instances for actually fighting, that type of thing. But you and I would not be responsible to go around to each one of the different bureaucracies and to try to interact with them. Our first touch point into the political system, into the system of food and you know, distribution of goods and things like that, would be through our commune council. Now they may point us in a direction, say, go talk to them. Here's your pass from the commune council. Tell them who you are and what you need. And if they have any questions, have them give us a call.
Sort of a chain of request rather than a chain of demand.
Exactly.
Or command, I mean.
Yeah, exactly. As well as I think the fundamental piece there, the really operant piece for me, is the fact that as opposed to the individual standing naked against the state and capital, now you have the bloc community, you know, the commune, the council standing together and representing the individuals on the bloc. It's I hate to say it, but it is a piece of Butchin's communalism. This is kind of what he was talking about. And having seen it play out a couple of times and hearing about it, how it worked during the siege, it appears to be a viable model within the context of Rojavan, you know, the Rojavan experience. How it would play out elsewhere, I have no idea. But it's, you know, to reflect back for a moment, it's the type of thing that we would have seen if we would have been in Spain for at least the first six or seven months of that revolution. We would have seen a very similar thing if we had been in Paris in 1871, during the spring of 1871. We would have seen not necessarily commune councils, but we would have seen the local political clubs acting as our advocates for food, clothing, lots of wine, that type of thing.
Wow. I'm gonna jump off on a different tangent for just a second because it came to me, and I heard this mentioned on the the Brilliant podcast. Sorry, okay. when they were talking in episode 9 about, like, well, this person who's been putting these posts up just came back, and you know, they're going to be talking a lot about what they saw in Rojava. And Bellamy mentioned, I don't remember, actually it might have been Aragorn, but one of them mentioned this phrase, and I didn't pick this up in any of the dispatches that you wrote, but maybe it was there or in one of the comments, but people yelling death to Gilgamesh?
They had used that a couple of times, but I had, it's an interesting concept. When I was in Paris with the HDP, which are essentially PKK, PYD, I stumbled across a protest on November 1st, which was International Kobani Day, and spent maybe 45 minutes to an hour with some HPD foreign affairs representatives who were in Paris for that protest. And we were there was a woman there, a Turkish woman, which was really refreshing, you know, because you just, wow, somebody not a Kurd who's getting kind of what's going on with this. Not only not a Kurd, but a woman from Turkey. And she and I were talking, and we got talking about the Middle East stuff. And she said, well, you know, we started civilization and we're going to stop it. And we're going to redo civilization the right way this time. You know, and when I heard that, and then I heard the death to Gilgamesh thing, it was like, that's exactly what this woman was saying. It was kind of like, oops, you know, profit, the laying up of surplus, the ability to purchase with surplus, that type of thing. Mistake. Sorry about that. You know, 10,000 bad years. We'll pay you back. We've got a better idea. You know, and this is where, you know, I think for me, the rubber hits the road, because, you know, you read some of the comments and it's like, well, this is really specific and it's very, you know, the innovations there are just for the Kurds because it's based in Kurdish culture and Islamic etiquettes and things like that. That's not how it's viewed by the people who are doing it. That's how it's viewed by people who are living in the Bay Area or New York or, you know, Paris or London or whatever. The Kurds are real clear. We're trying to remake civilization in a way that's more humane. We apologize for the Fertile Crescent. We'll try it again. You know,
that's a lot of guilt to be carrying.
I don't think they really carry that much guilt, but I think
I'm sorry for McDonald's.
At least this woman voiced it incredibly beautifully.
Yeah,
you know, as she was talking about it, basically saying, you know. Oops. Who knew?
So since you've kind of touched on it, I know you're going to be doing a lot more writing, and this is already a long conversation, but I do want to ask another thing that I didn't put into the questions before. Since we're on this topic of critique of civilization, accumulation of wealth, we talked about the capitalism, we talked about the patriarchy. The way it's been described to me in the past, and when I talked to Dilardrik last year about what was going on in Rojava, I didn't get a very clear answer, and I haven't gotten a very clear answer about like what the ecological aspect of the revolution, if it's like viewed as being on these three large pillars of anti-capitalism, feminist, and ecological or green. What do you know about that?
No, it's huge. No, that's a really good question. I'm glad we touched on it because it hasn't. I haven't touched on it much in the dispatches at all. But I was meeting with the. Minister, the defense minister, effectively the defense advisor for Kobani, and we were talking a little bit about the siege and kind of the mess that was left after the siege, like the entire like city f-ing destroyed, that type of thing. And then he brought up the ecological thing, and he said, you know, this is an ecological disaster. And I said, well, can you follow up on that? Can you tell me a little bit about what your feelings are? And he says, well, imagine what's buried underneath our streets, all the lead, the American bombs, which likely have depleted uranium in them. All the unexploded explosive devices, all the, you know, the burned explosives. And I immediately knew what he was talking about because the minute I got to Kobani, I picked up, even though I smoke, I picked up a nasty ass lung infection and still have it to this day. I need to go see a doctor at some point in time, but the air there is really, really bad. I mean, and it's not bad because there's a lot of dust in it. It's bad because there's, you know, a month long battle was fought there, and all the nasty stuff from all the ordnance is still in the air or buried underneath the ground. And they're disturbing it on a daily basis. They're trying to take care of it by using water to douse the dust a little bit. But you know, I mean, it's catch as catch can. You know, I mean, it's a big city. You can't dust every street every 20 minutes. Just not gonna, or you can't water every street every 20 minutes. It's just not going to happen. So of all people, the defense minister is the guy who raises the issue of the ecology, and it's particularly this ecological issue. And I said, so what can you do about it? He says, you know, we would love to be able to address it now. We would love to be able to bring engineers and to do some get some ideas to just exactly how toxic the stuff is, as well as how potentially dangerous it is for the water table and growing and people who are living here. But we can't, you know, right now we're in the midst of this war, and, you know, there's just no way that we can actually tackle any of the ecological stuff. And I said, but you see it as a priority as the revolution matures. And he says, you know, his attitude was that, you know, once my soldiers, you know, once peace prevails, my soldiers start fighting for the environment.
And what does that look like? Doing the cleanup and doing the reinvigorating. Cleanup.
I think within the urban areas, Kobani and Sarikanye, which is also in Kobani province, which had some pretty significant battles. They were smaller affairs, but just as nasty. You know, helping with the cleanup. I think, and not only helping with the cleanup, but helping with the disposal is going to be the issue. What do you do with all this lethal ordnance and these bullets, which were, you know, I'm sure they're all full metal jacket. I hope they were, but that still means that there's lead in them, you know, and lead, as we all know, can make you pretty stupid if you let it get into the water system, that type of thing. So the recognition is that once, you know, you can pull back some of these soldiers, you now have individuals who can help out with some of the reconstruction, as well as some of the work with the environment, that type of thing. In terms of the environment, generally in Rojava, I mean, it's when you drive through it, it's a developing country. There are open, you know, dumps, and those, I would imagine, you know, at least from what I've read, not necessarily what I've seen, are in the process. They're in the process of trying to figure out just exactly how to deal with some of the dumps, some of the open dumps. That have been allowed to happen. Now, the Syrians, they, you know, when they were doing the oil wells, and the oil wells, there's only a few that are pumping right now. I think a lot of the oil is actually still has sufficient pressure that they don't really need kind of the dinosaur looking pumps. You know, they're still pulling it out from underneath. But the Syrians, you know, oil will pool at the top of any given well, and they can't use that oil because it's contaminated. So what the Syrians did is they just dug pits and then drained this oil off into pits. Well, if you know anything about oil, that oil is going to get into the water table, and that water table is going to be effectively destroyed. So there is a lot of environmental stuff, some of it very small and some of it really important to be able to deal with. And I think that given the dearth of building materials, resources, expertise right now, that they don't have the ability to really even develop any consistent tactical plans or strategic plans as to how to work with it. The commitment to work with it is there. And it was, you know, it's relatively plain when you talk to some of the folks, especially this defense minister, how they're going to tackle it in the future. Unsure. It's one of the things that they just don't, I mean, it's crazy. They don't have the money and the resources to be able to do either the human resources, you know, the engineers, you know, on the ground, the engineers, or the ability to, like with these oil dumps that the Syrians have done, you would obviously need to build concrete sarcophagi around them and to segregate them from groundwater. Because some of them have got to be 50, 60, 70 years old.
Yeah, that's so much infrastructure. If you're trying to like rebuild hospitals and rebuild homes, exactly. And
yeah, no, exactly. In other words, I mean, you would need, you know, digging devices to be able to get around and underneath. You need to drain off initially the oil that's there, take it someplace, have it destroyed, get it, you know, and then dig the sarcophagi, and then, you know, some type of draining system so that the drain systems were just open canals, right? Just little open canals that were maybe a feet wide draining off these oil wells. So, I mean, it was a disaster. And of course the Syrian government didn't care. This was a Kurdish area, you know, it's not their problem. So there's a lot there that can be done, and that will be one of the interesting things over time to be able to see, as the revolution expands, just exactly how they're going to address some of the ecological issues. Some of them are just standard ecological issues, you know, that would come from a country that's in the process of just developing and, you know, working with garbage and sewage and that type of thing. Some of them are overarchingly nasty. Like, as I say, Kobani is really, really, really going to have to deal with some of the ordinance that's there. You know, I shudder to think of what's buried under those streets. You know, it's going to take a while to be able to deal with that. And some of it is just going to have to be, I mean, a lot of the streets are effectively mud at this stage of the game. Some of the response is just going to be have to, you know, repaving of the streets, but repaving with concrete, not tarmac, to be able to attempt to seal some of the material off, and then finding the real nasty areas and digging those out before they can get down to groundwater, which unfortunately groundwater, as we talked about before, between Tigris and Euphrates is relatively shallow.
Yeah.
So that's one of the reasons why Mohammed, the translator, his dad was a dug wells. And I think that one of the reasons he stays in business and continues to dig wells is because wells keep getting poisoned by virtue of some of the material that's in the, that's buried in the ground. So the answer is yes, they're concerned about ecology, but boy, right now they just don't have the ability to or resources to be able to address it in any effective fashion.
Did you hear much in the way outside of dealing with how destroyed it's become by past practices of their communities, but also more so by the Syrian government and by the war, like outside of mitigating like the negative consequences of the war and being a developing country, did you hear any ideas about like what people were talking about in terms of long scale plans of what political economy would look like outside of capitalism and outside of ecological destruction?
In terms of long term at the political economic level, the issue ultimately that was presented to me over and over again is that they don't want a political economy that's based in what they saw with the Syrians, which is kind of their touchstone into capitalism, which is, it's the same political economy as the U.S. The more you can purchase, the better you are. The Kurds that I spoke to, Tevdem, individuals on the street, things like that, really kind of, there's a rejection there. There's a fundamental rejection there of that's what they want to do. They recognize that, that working together as a society and as a full society, that if they let one part of society fall behind, a group of individuals fall behind, they will have failed fundamentally. I guess the one goal that I think I delineated more than anything else, and it's one of the reasons why I was in Père Lachaise, I went to Oscar Wilde's grave and put a YPG flag on it and took a picture, is because, in his The Soul of Man Under Socialism, he writes that the entire point of a humane political economy is to make poverty impossible. And my sense is that is a restatement of what I was hearing over and over again from economic Tevdem, even the YPG commander, who was pretty astute at the political level, is the issue is not necessarily one of everybody getting a new car, but the issue is one of making sure that nobody starves and that everyone has a roof over their head. A very, like I said, the impossibility of poverty, I think, is where, as a minimum strategic goal, is where they're headed right now. What that looks like over time, I don't know. I don't know how that plays out. But I think that I can pretty much say that that's what I heard.
Post-scarcity anarchism.
Exactly. Exactly.
He still seemed like a bastard, but he was a smart guy, I guess.
Who, Butchin?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, some of it, I'm losing a lot of disrespect for a lot of people these days, and it's actually kind of a rather pleasant process. And some of the stuff that he, he wrote as it was translated by this guy, Ocalan, it just makes a lot of sense. It's just being applied in a process that just strikes me as being humane, not authoritarian. People are given a voice in it. Their feet aren't held to the fire to be revolutionaries or not. People are walking kind of their own paths. It's just, I'm sure you'll play the song, but it appeals to me too, because I have a real interest in cultural issues, and it's playing out in the level of culture, everything from kind of the face of the urban environment in Qamishli and things like that, with flags and the red, the gold, and the green of the flag of Rojava, to beginning to get workshops to help people to learn how to paint and work with the plastic arts. I haven't told anybody this, but when I was, this is another thing. I was in Kobani and they had just done a series of matinees for all the kids in Kobani. Do you know what movie they showed?
Mm-mm. What?
The Kid by Charlie Chaplin.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. They had like 700 kids over the course of 4 or 5 days. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, that's... It's, I mean, well, he's... Yeah, I mean, Charlie Chaplin. Socialist, maybe anarchist. Also internationally renowned as just universally communicative of like values and humanity and stuff. That's so cool.
Oh, and I when I heard that, and it was like just over as I was getting into Kopani, it was like one of those, oh, wouldn't you love to be in the audience with like 40 or 50 Kurdish little kids watching the kid?
I know.
It would be like so awesome.
Oh, that's so cool.
And then on at the other cultural level, and you guys will have this song. I'm sure you'll play it at some point in time. You know, the popular music, the songs are reflective of what's going on. And, you know, as opposed to bull hip hop and, you know, dubstep and things like that, some real interesting lyrics are falling out. And, you know, the one that you'll that I'll get to you is, you know, the piece of the lyrics for, and this is a lyric. This is a lyric written by Arabs, sung in Arabic, and with a very Arabic music line to it, is, you know, Kurds, Christians, and Arabs are brothers. Support the YPJ. Allah, you know, God bless the YPJ, because they don't sleep and they guard the lands. And this is a militia that the YPG grows hope, you know. And so even at the level of popular music, the revolution is producing culture. And this is, you know, I first heard this was the taxi driver who was taking us around. And he got excited when he heard, you know, when this song came up. You know, this is one of his favorite tunes. It was like, God. So culturally, things are happening. I mean, it's not just the social, the economic, the gender issues, but it's happening at the level of the visual, the level of sound and music and you know, film. And that's important too. And they get it. That's important.
Do you know who produced the song? Are they like, is there like a Ministry of Culture type thing, or is it?
There is. I talked to the Minister of Culture, woman, and they're in the process. They produced two films so far, just short films, and it sounds to me like they're kind of propaganda films about the YPG, which, you know, in the midst of a war, in the midst of a revolution, didn't surprise me at all, right? Like Eisenstein, you know, that type of thing.
Oh, yeah.
So, but they're also interested in producing a soap opera. Kind of a daily or an every other day soap opera about life in Kobani. And, you know, would start during the siege and then kind of go through, you know, and you know, kind of like days of our lives in the Rojavan revolution.
Yeah, that's
like
that's an interesting way to try to like frame internationally how people would be people in all the like outlying outside of Kobani, all the Kurds that are going to be watching it and be like, all right, this is like, you know what I mean? Like framing sort of how they, what language they use, what parables they use. And I wonder how much it'll be internally consumed by the population. If people will be like, oh yeah, that's totally reflective of what the situation is. Or, oh, this is utter propaganda from the YPJ, YPG.
Right, and it's, you know, it's, it'll be interesting. I don't know if they're going to be able to do it or not, because, you know, even producing these short films, I think they were 20 or 30 minutes as they were described to me. And I just got – one was just going into pre-production, so they wouldn't show me any rushes that they had. And then the other one was just going into – they were editing it in Paris for music. So it was final post-production. It was just about ready to be released. So they wouldn't even let me see, like, the final cut from post-production before it went into the music. It's like, oh, f-. You know, I felt it was like total cinematic blue balls. So we'll have to see. And then finally, they have their own TV station. Like I think we mentioned this yesterday, Rojava TV. Mm-hmm. So, and while it's basically a few slides and a crawl during the course of the day, it does come on at night. And I did over the course in Khamisli, primarily, not necessarily in Kobani, because people don't have electricity yet. Most people don't have electricity yet. But in Khamisli, this was one of the things that people would watch. And they have access to, you know, everybody's got satellites on the roof. So they have access to thousands of radio or TV stations. But when Rojava TV is on, you know, I would say that probably a quarter or maybe a third of the television sets that I saw in restaurants and hotels and things like that were tuned at least to the news program. because it's the only place that they can get specific Rojava news. So, and I met some of the folks who were responsible for some of those reports. One was the ceremony transferring the bodies, the YPG and YPJ fighters. There was a Rojava TV reporter there with the camera and things like that. So again, what we're looking at here is people also beginning the process of reclaiming their culture, reclaiming their language, reclaiming kind of who they are, and then translating that into new cultural forms. So,
yeah. And I guess put back into the context of the fact that, as you mentioned, Assad's father, and also in Turkey, it was illegal to speak Kurdish.
Yes. So that, yeah. I don't know if I touched on this or not. Do we talk about the university in Qamishli?
No, we didn't.
Okay, just real quick. Well, you mentioned the Irish. Now, one of the pieces that went hand in hand with the Irish Revolution and the Civil War was kind of the resurrection, if you will, of the Irish language. And because of what had gone on with Kurmanji, the very first university that was founded by the Kurds after freeing up Qamishli was, they teach two things. They teach Kurmanji at a college level and Kurdish culture. So that's the very first university. And again, it's kind of reminiscent of, even Trinity College with the 1921 Free State, Trinity College introduced an entire curriculum around Irish as well as Irish and Gaelic culture.
And Irish being taught in schools after that point, whereas same thing, it was illegal to speak
Gaelic. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that translates today in Ireland where kids still have to prove that they're fluent in Irish to be able to graduate from high school.
Even though it's a dying language and nobody actually speaks it.
Well, yeah, but it's
perfect. Except so that the tourists don't understand what they're saying.
Well, and it's perfect for being confused by traffic signs and whatnot. When you're in Ireland, it's like, what the fuck?
not
I thought this was Dublin. It says Atha Clay Bailey, It's like, where the fuck am I?
Not quite as practiced as the Welsh, but.
No, yeah, exactly. Or Manx.
Yeah, right. I can honestly say I've never seen a Manx sign, street sign or whatever.
Be grateful.
Yeah. Be burned into my retinas.
Cool. Exactly. So that kind of gives a feel for what I think is going on, what I saw there, what I experienced there. And just to go in again, just to be real clear, if this appeals to people, if they're interested in participating, there are two things that I recommend they do. The first is to alienate, to do as much as is humanly possible to embarrass the Turkish government. Right now, the greatest harm that's being done to this revolution is the sealing of the Turkish border and the inability of goods, services, professionals, technicians, individuals to get across that border. The loss is insurmountable, as well as the fact that the Turks happen to be recruiting Daesh fighters in their refugee camps and then opening up the border for them to sneak across. So Turkey, if you want to talk, like I said before, if there's a war criminal that's alive today that's identifiable, and I assume Pinochet is dead, it's Erdogan. And we need to be clear as a community for those who are engaged with the Rojava revolution that this has got to stop. This nonsense has got to stop. And, fortunately, that doesn't require that we do any type of voting or anything like that, but it appeals directly to some of the more direct action type of techniques. I'm sure that people who are listening to this will understand. And the second piece of that, and this is real specific for individuals who have technical skills, and I mean any type of technical skills, engineers, technicians, medical personnel, anything that could potentially help to build infrastructure or to bring the community back, particularly around Kobane, contact the Rojava plan or Lions of Rojava. Let them know what your specialty is. And if you have the time, if you have the money, if you're able to do it, go there. Or, if you can't, maybe you can assist from here with working for them. But they really, at this point in time, they need it. That's one thing that they really lack. So, it will afford people, you, an opportunity to feel something firsthand, which probably most of us didn't think we'd ever get a chance to feel. I hope I can bring back a touch of that to folks here, but there's nothing like standing on free land.
Well, let's hope it spreads. Actually, do you know? Okay, so there was something I was meaning to ask a question, but I couldn't find the link to the BBC story. But I heard a BBC story a couple of weeks ago when I was driving home from work, and it was on World Service, and they were talking about a village in Turkey near, I assume, near the border with Rojava that had gone over and basically said, like, no, we're now a part of Rojava. Like, our schools are now going to be teaching in Kurdish, and they're going to be teaching the teachings of Öcalan.
A number of places in Turkey have actually declared effective independence from Turkey in the Kurdish areas. The biggest one, you know, and this is part and parcel of what happened there with the November revolution or the November election and kind of the things leading up to the November election. And in many ways, it's de facto what has been the reality there for the past two or three years. Some of the cities are in effective Kurdish control. Cizre, which is sits in the kind of the crotch of two mountains, and up in those mountains are where the PKK, headquarters are, and things like that. So, yeah, no, absolutely true. There are areas in Turkey where not only are they contested by the Turkish army, but the Turkish army basically is effectively lost, and which are in effective control of the Kurds. And whether they've joined with Rojava or not, again, they don't recognize that border, so they would probably consider themselves part of Rojava anyway, I would think. So, but I would imagine that, you know, the teaching of schools and things like that continues apace. And this is where, by the way, some of the bloc and the council commune preliminary structures have been tested and tried in some of these villages prior to their, moving into Rojava and their implementation there. So one of the reasons why I think those structures work so well is because they've basically been, you know, they've been through a number of test runs in larger communities in Turkey, and what didn't work was, you know, thrown out, and what did work was emphasized.
That's incredible.
So yes, that would be the answer is yes.
Well, so where can listeners find your writing as you continue to put out stuff and do more interviews on the subject?
Most of the stuff is going to get posted through anarchistnews.org and then, on the website for Modern Slavery, which is, modernslavery.com/CalPress. Just Google that and it will take you to, the radio interviews as well as where I'm presenting. If this gets out, my first speaking engagement specifically about this in an anarchist space is on Monday, November 16th, I'm sorry, next week, at the base in Brooklyn, which is on Myrtle Avenue. And that's on Facebook. If you'll look under El Arante on Facebook, I think it will drop, or the base, bkthebase.com.org, bkthebase.org is their website. So, and then my personal email with CalPress is paul@CalPress, CalPress.org. And if people have questions, if they want to ask if I can come out and speak to groups, or if they want pictures or anything like that, please don't hesitate to contact me. I'd be delighted to be able to provide you with whatever you need. I went over to Rojava to come back as a tabula rasa, but also to come back as a resource for the materials that I have brought back so that I can help people try to understand a little bit of what's going on there. And being a firm advocate of anti-copyright, that means that everything I did there basically belongs to every anarchist in the world.
Well, thank you so much for all that you're doing and have done, as I said yesterday, and also for taking the time to have this two series of long conversations with me.
Totally my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on. And I look forward to getting out to Asheville and seeing you guys.
Yeah.
Sometime.